Welcome, everybody. We'll get started. So it's my great pleasure to introduce this week's colloquium speaker, which is Robert Digraph. So I'll tell you a little bit about his biography. So he did his PhD at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands with Gerard Etouft. He had held positions at Princeton and the Institute for Advanced Study before becoming a professor at the University of Amsterdam. And about 5 years ago, he became a director and Leon Levy professor at the Institute for Advanced Study. His research is in string theory and mathematical physics. And for this research, he was awarded the Spinoza Prize, which is the highest scientific award in the Netherlands in 2003. This goes on and on, but he is also past president of the Royal Netherlands Society for Arts and Sciences. He's the current president of the Inter-Academy of Sciences, which is an alliance of national academies for science and medicine and engineering. He's also very passionate about science education and science outreach, and he's an advisor on public policy. And last year, he wrote down some of his views in an essay, which is essentially about the importance of basic research for technological innovation. And the title of the book is the same as the title of the talk, and that's what he's going to tell us about today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here and to speak on this topic of the importance of basic research. And I feel a little bit, I think the expression in English is to bringing coals to Newcastle. I think in Dutch, we say bringing water to the sea, which is because I think all of you here are as convinced as anybody else about the need of basic research. And indeed, this year, I had the pleasure, we reissued this little booklet, which is the essay by Abram Flexner. I will tell you a little bit more about him. He was the founding director of the Institute for Advanced Study about the wonderful title, Usefulness of Useless Knowledge, and I wrote an introductory part to it. So I've been on my kind of useless book tour. And my aim is to make useless kind of a badge of honor. So I want, I think, a whole line of merchandising, you know, useless t-shirts, useless coffee cups. But when the book came out, actually, you know, one of the claims of fame was Flexner was to get Albert Einstein to Princeton. Here they are together. So I thought, I went to the publisher, I said, well, it would be terrific. Well, Einstein must have said something nice about Flexner. So wouldn't it be great to have a blurb on the book say, Albert Einstein, I highly recommend this book, would be a first. So then I look up this ultimate book of Einstein quotations, the ultimate quotable Einstein, Flexner, and there's one entry. So I think I'm in luck. I look it up and it says, Abram Flexner, one of my few enemies. So then my proposal was to put this on the book, you know. Albert Einstein, a book by one of my few enemies. I think it might have sold, but I actually want to come at the back, at the end of the lecture, I want to come back to this point, why, you know, apart from the usual tension between faculty and directors, why actually Albert Einstein had such a strong view and where it comes from. So this essay was published in October 1939, which is in many ways, you know, the world was at a very bad time. You know, World War II had just started, and I think, you know, I will. It's kind of wonderful that at that very difficult part, Flexner felt he had to make the case of the importance of the arts, the sciences, and our basic quest to understand the world. And in my opening essay, I used this image of the world of tomorrow, which was actually the title of the New York's World's Fair. It opened in April 1939. And the whole theme was to give a view of what the future would look like. And some things were pretty good, actually. It was the first time that television was shown in North America. In fact, at that point, there were 300 television sets in the US. And the first broadcast was actually President Roosevelt opening the fair. And actually, the first fax machine, the first automatic washing machines, which might have done more to advance civilization than anything else. It also was a view backwards, like there was a lot of attention given of the latest steam engines, and I think they were on their way. And one thing I love particularly, you know, it was also the first robot. So he was called Electro. He could smoke a cigarette, and he had a little robot dog, Sparky, that you could play with. And here's
Electro,
a little clip.
Come here. And here he comes, ladies and gentlemen, walking up to greet you under his own power.
He was voice activated. The robot could speak by playing gramophone records. In some sense, way around the time. There was a second opening speech by Einstein. Einstein was chair of the scientific committee advising the fair. And he tried to speak about cosmic rays. That was the topic he picked. So there was actually an opening act. The rays would be caught, whatever that meant, in the Hayden Planetarium in Midtown Manhattan, transferred by telephone to the fairgrounds. And when the 10th ray was captured, a big switch was thrown, and the light show should have started. But in fact, all the fuses blew. And there's a wonderful little episode in the next day's New York Times where it said, well, the audience left the room to find a spectacle they could applaud. So in terms of science outreach and communication, was a failure. Also, Einstein's heavy German accent didn't help very much, I think. But I mentioned it because there were two things he didn't mention. He didn't talk about nuclear physics, and he didn't talk about computers. Well, you could argue that they would change the world pretty soon. And in fact, they were happening right under his nose. So at the Institute, which was founded in 1930s, first professors came in 1933, it has a role that, you know, I think Perimeter would ascribe to too, seeking eternal truth in a world of chaos. This is a picture from the New York Times magazine. I just love it because of the large looming shadow of Einstein that, you know, any physicist wants to escape, I think, you know. It's a beautiful picture. But of course, you know, Einstein, we all associate him immediately with nuclear physics. In fact, in August of that year, he would write the famous letter to Roosevelt together with Szilard. Here you see them writing the letter, starting essentially the Manhattan Project. Always wondered why had they had the vision to take a photograph writing this letter. And in fact, because you always see this picture, in fact, it's a reenactment from 1945. So they were pretending to write the letter. A second thing is what was happening at the Institute. In the 1930s, it actually was the center of mathematical logic. John von Neumann was recruited as a mathematician. His claim to fame at that point was algebra, quantum, the basic theory about quantum mechanics and logic. Kurt Gödel came, Alonzo Church at the university, Alan Turing was a graduate student. So a lot of interest in the concept of a theoretical concept of a machine that could kind of prove any possible theoretical mathematical statement. And then at some point, von Neumann says, no, I'm thinking about something more important than bombs, because he was working also on the atom bomb. I'm thinking about computing machines. And then he decided that he wanted to build one. So the first modern architecture, we say now von Neumann architecture computer, was built at IAS. In fact, it was built out of war surplus material, because nobody felt a computer is important enough to spend some real money. And I like to say it was a triple helix project before the double helix was invented. So it was triple helix was supported by philanthropy, by government, Department of War, and companies, RCA and IBM. And von Neumann had a very liberal attitude because he sent blueprints of the machine across the world. So there was no IP. He felt that, in some sense, the shared it. So remarkable thing is that this little institute where Einstein was working, that within a few years, you had both him, at that point, father of the peace movement, you had von Neumann, who was the coldest of cold warriors, who used really his game theory to argue that the US should bomb the Soviet Union immediately. There's a famous anecdote where people, is it true, Professor von Neumann, that you want to build tomorrow? He said, no, this afternoon. Because first strike was his thing. And of course, Oppenheimer, who was kind of caught in between of that. So it's a wonderful indication how within a decade these abstract ideas were totally transforming the world. And went on. You know, that computer had a 32 by 32 bit memory. It was made out of these kind of television tubes that would glow a little bit, and that was the memory, literally the glow on the screen. And actually, von Neumann used it immediately with other applications in mind. For instance, the first modern computerized weather prediction was done. fact, the weather prediction of the 5th of January of 1949, the point is that at that point in time, the computer was very slow. It took 48 hours to predict tomorrow's weather. So it's a perfect post-diction. But then, within a relatively short time, they get it down. Again, this is on this less than 1,000 bits of memory. Get it down to 8 hours. And then I think it's quite amazing for Norman and us to write for Fortune magazine in 1955 an article under the title, Can We Survive Technology? And he makes 2 points, and I think both of them are important. So you might think this is all about nuclear arms, the height of the Cold War. Small fraction of the article is about nuclear bombs. The rest of it is about climate change, and in fact, not only natural climate change, but climate change almost as a weapon of destruction. And he writes that this will merge each nation's affair with each other more thoroughly than the threat of nuclear any war may already have done. So he, in some sense, had this vision that climate change would literally entangle the interests of people. And of course it did. And although he was such a technologist, it's interesting also at the very end how he ends the piece. He says, you know, the problems can only be solved by relying on human qualities, patience, flexibility, intelligence. So there's also a very humanist point of view. So I also want to tell you a few words about Flexner, if only to illustrate a kind of man and an impact people can have on society, which is slightly different from, I would say, the role that we typically assign to scientists. So Flexner, by the way, when he passed away in 1959, his obituary was on the front page of the New York Times. And it said that nobody in his generation had done more for the nation and the world. And yet, he is, I would say, largely forgotten. He made a little cameo appearance just a few years ago when there was an interview with Warren Buffett, the philanthropist, and he suddenly takes Flexner's biography out of his back pocket. He said, oh, this was an American hero, because he wasn't a philanthropist, he wasn't a scientist, but he was able to connect the two in a very useful way. So Flexner came from this family, a Jewish immigrant family, St. Louis, who went through the major depression in the 1870s, lost all of their money. Father had a small pharmacy. Flexner was able to go to college, the first one, because of the efforts of his older brother. He went to Johns Hopkins University, which was the first modern research university in the U.S., and said I could only pay for 2 years, and it was fine. He studied classics, finished in 2 years. In fact, many of the Flexner brothers became... Simon Flexner was the first president, famous biologist, became the first president of what's now Rockefeller University. Bernard Flexner was a diplomat, a philanthropist. And Abram Flexner, he started by becoming a high school teacher in St. Louis and was famous after 1 year because he failed the full class. Very high standards. Then he created his own school, and at some point, Simon Flexner felt that they had to do something about medical education in North America. And he said, well, I'm just the right person to do this, Abram Flexner. It took 2 years to do. He produced a report. It's known as the Flexner Report. And I like to joke that anybody who does any work in a commission, we should have a unit of effectiveness of any committee work, which is the Flexner. And I think if you can approach a micro-Flexner or a nano-Flexner, that would be great. Because as a result of this report, essentially 90%, 90, of all medical schools in North America were closed or completely changed. At that point, medical education was for profit, was an undergraduate, you didn't see any patients, you didn't do any research, it was just a scam. And he didn't mince words. In fact, there was only one or two institutions that he was enthusiastic about, among other things, Johns Hopkins. And Flexner became a critic of institutions. Now, he wrote a famous book, Criticizing Universities. This is the early 30s. He is speaking about Columbia, criticizing that a modern university held a high regard to German research universities, that there are courses in practical poultry raising, beekeeping, you know, this very practical attitude that particularly in the 1930s was rampant, you know, because people felt we are in a depression, we have to do practical, immediate stuff. And he was arguing for the difference. So he got an opportunity to change this when he was given this very large grant at that time by the Bamberger family. They actually sold the department store they had in Newark to Macy's in three weeks before the Wall Street crash. So they were one of the few who had money. They wanted to create a medical school, went to Flexner and said, I want to create a medical school which has no biases. He said, there's no need to do that. There's already an institution like that run by my brother. I have a bigger idea. I want to create a center of pure thinking. And their answer was, well, Mr. Flexner, now for many decades you have been criticizing the world. You should give the world an opportunity to criticize you, and so you should lead this. And then there's this moment in time when, of course, the United States is put to the test. Actually, it happens in April 1933, where Europe essentially goes into flame, and there's a very intense discussion. What should we do? And actually, this goes back to the conflict with Einstein. Flexner says, well, you know, we have to provide jobs for Americans. He said, literally right somewhere, if you have another 100 Einsteins, they could do something. But, you know, the rest, all these other refugees, all these scholars, what can we do? And then he gets convinced, and with the help of the Rockefeller Foundation and Einstein and others, they start this tremendous effort in the 1930s to get scholars, you know, at risk. Refugees, political or Jewish scientists who lost their jobs and their livelihood. To get them over, and by giving them very small grants. So one of the jokes is that the Bamberger family, they had this department store dealing in distressed merchandise, and now there was certainly a market for distressed geniuses. You know, you could have, you see here some of the prizes, you know, you could get a Kurt Gödel for $4,000, you know, greatest logician after in two millennia. And then he writes, and I think that's quite telling. Flexner comes around and he writes in May 1939 that from now, if the historian looking backward in 50 years, they will say that if we act with courage and imagination, that during our time, the center of gravity of scholarship have moved across the Atlantic. Now, he also, if you read the rest of the passage, he makes the point that centers of gravity have always crossed around the world. And he was very, very much aware that this movement will not stop. And no, many people comment on the present political situation in the U.S. and say, oh, it's almost like the 1930s. So yes, it's exactly the same, up to a minus sign. Thinking, oh, it's the forces are pulling in another direction. So Flexner makes a wonderful case about this basic premise, how pure thinking, unobstructed pursuit of knowledge can have profound impacts on society. And he mentions the case, you know, of electricity, of people like Faraday that were doing, you know, experiments in the 1830s that were just amusement. You know, you had your hair raise up if you touched the electric bulb, you had magnets. There's this famous anecdote, I think it's apocryphal, but it's a beautiful story that the Chancellor of the Exchequer visited Faraday and asked, you know, what is this all good for? And he said, well, I don't know, but one day, sir, you may tax it. And indeed, we all pay taxes on our electricity bills, and if we could only have patented the Maxwell equations, for instance, you know, would have paid for all scientific research to the far future. There are other examples. I mean, looking backwards, it's so easy to make the case. Think about quantum mechanics. You know, quantum mechanics was an act of desperation, as Max Planck put it himself. He was willing to make any sacrifice to the principles of physics just to save science as it is, so some sense of understanding. It was a young boys, unfortunately, mostly boys game, you know, Knabenphysik in German, you know, they were still in Lederhose, some of them. Now it's estimated that 30% of our GDP is based on quantum mechanics. I would argue actually 100% of reality is based on quantum mechanics. So, in some sense, you know, you could ask, you know, turn H bar to zero, does your device still work? I think, you know, your washing machine probably will. But and of course, again, preaching to the converted here. That's, you know, definitely the vision here too, that, you know, we are just at the... This might actually be 100% pretty soon, when quantum computing, etc., comes online. Think about the impact that the life science have had. So there's this simple fact that in the last few centuries, at least in the West, life expectancy has tripled, which is an amazing number. But it's very hard to pinpoint exactly when this happened. You know, there has been continuous effort, basic science, engineering, sewages, you know, hygiene. And the remarkable thing is that tripling of life expectancy has happened across the world, and even faster. You know, it took 3 centuries in the West. It has happened within a century in, for instance, in Africa. So there's this remarkable thing about technology. I think that we're kind of aware of it, but we're not perhaps fully appreciating. So there are many definitions of technology. Just for fun, this is one of my things I like. You know, everything discovered after we're born, you call it technology. Or everything that doesn't work, I like that one too. If it worked and was already there, you know, I love, our children don't think of the internet as technology or a smartphone. You know, it just was there. But of course, it's also the dominant force that shapes and changes nature and culture. And so it's remarkable to go back at the very root of these innovations. Now, there's even something that I would like to call the uselessness of useless knowledge. That is to say, these technologies drive, again, basic research. And my favorite example, if only because it was discovered in the Netherlands, is superconductivity. It was discovered in 1911. Is this ability of materials, if they cool down enough through quantum effects, electric currents can flow forever. Remarkable, there was a Solvay Congress in 1911 where Kamerling Onnes didn't even mention it, wasn't even discussed. So it took some time for the physics community to realize how important it is. Another story I really like about Onnes is that when he was became professor in Leiden in the Netherlands, what he did, he didn't recruit faculty. He didn't build a lab. What he did, he built a school for lab assistants, because he felt he had to train the technicians to facilitate the technology to make that breakthrough. So it took 10 years for these lab assistants were at a level where they could build equipment that was far ahead of the competition. And then he had a run of 10, 20 years where nobody could catch him. Now, this phenomena, which was totally unannounced, superconductivity, has caused terrific applications. Now it's used in magnetic, building strong magnets, essentially, like in maglev trains, in fMRI scanners. So you could argue the whole field of neuroscience, the fact that we're living now in this wonderful age and we understand the brain with tremendous consequences for diagnostics and treatment, became because of this technological innovation. In fact, a lot of the tools of quantum computing are being applied, again, using superconductivity. But I think the most important application from my point of view is in the coldest spot on Earth, which is the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Geneva. So there's this big ring and there are terrific magnets that bend the particles. In order to build these magnets, they have to be superconducting. So you can argue the discovery of the Higgs particle is a direct consequence of superconductivity. And if you're a theoretical physicist, there's actually some nice poetry in the fact that the description of the Higgs effect is very similar to the way we describe superconductivity. So there's even a kind of a rhyming in theoretical ideas. Now, we all witnessed this wonderful event in 2012, when the Higgs particle was discovered. At the Nobel Prize ceremony, I saw something remarkable. So there were some good friends, even my own thesis advisor, sitting in the audience. And so these are the laureates who got the prize earlier. And I think, wait a moment, they got a prize earlier, but their work was later. How can that be? Well, Peter Higgs was very fortunate, in his own words, that he was young enough to make the prediction, so that he could live to see it happen. It was a 50-year prediction. These things, 50 years is a relatively short period in intellectual history. And if you look at the list of particles, I like this graph, you see the length between the moment the particle was hypothesized and it was discovered. Now, there are some, like the muon, that famously, when it was discovered, somebody said, who ordered this? Because nobody predicted it would be there. But you see, the Higgs boson is actually, with 50 years, by far the longest prediction interval, so to say. And we go into this realm. We are now in a moment where we have 50-year predictions. In fact, we have 100-year predictions, because Another great event, of course, that you all witnessed here and the whole world celebrated was the detection of gravitational waves, which in some sense you can think, at least in the classical realm, of detecting a wave, a classical particle, the graviton that Einstein predicted in 1915. So that's a good example of a 100-year prediction. And so the fact that 100 years is a serious effort from beginning to the end, and that you know, science is able to bridge these many generations. When we had this centennial of Einstein's relativity theory, I find it remarkable, looking up some of the obituaries of Einstein, so he passed away in 1955, that his theory was described as a great work of art, a wonderful philosophy. That's like, that's dreadful, you know, to have you as a scientist, to have your theory explained as a piece of art. Because it was, at that point, very far away from direct technological observations. And so needed another 50 years of increased, sophisticated technology to make, actually, that discovery. So this is an image that I'm very fond of, which is, I think, in a wonderful way captures the process of scientific discovery. This is William Herschel, the famous astronomer, discoverer of the planet Uranus. He was, by the way, a composer and musician. He wrote 30 symphonies before he moved from Germany to England and pursued his career as a scientist. And this is the discovery of infrared light. So he has this famous idea of measuring the temperature of the various colors. He first measures in the violet, measures some temperature, then he moves it to the red. It's warmer. And then he does something that only like a genius or a fool does. He puts the temperature outside the rainbow and measures an even warmer temperature. So just the image is lovely, I think, because we now know the rainbow continues to the left and the right. So you, how do you know what you don't know? And this, I think, is a wonderful moment. I always love these maps of the ancient cartographers, where they were mapping the world, but there were large parts which were unknown, kind of the blank spots. And these old map makers, they didn't dare to leave the map open. What they put is, they put these kind of sea monsters there, which I think, and I feel that's like what we are fighting as scientists. Now, it's the imagination that puts these sea monsters. And it's very important that we know what we don't know. So I would love to give that example of cosmology that you've heard undoubtedly many, many times, that essentially we're very happy, very lucky to know what we don't know. We know 95% of the universe, in some sense, missing. And that actually is terrific. That means that we can focus on these unknowns and we can study it. And it's these big questions that I think one thing that science does is illuminate the unknowns. Often it's said that what the main product of science is ignorance. Turns out there are so many things you were ignorant about. You wasn't even aware you were ignorant about before. So this, I think, phrase Feynman, of science as the belief in the ignorance of experts, that experts are able to have a frank view of the life. And as he said, you know, this, I think he put it very well, scientific knowledge is a statement, body of statement of varying degrees of certainty, some most unsure, some nearly sure, none absolute certain. There's always opening for increased knowledge. Another one of my favorites, Francis Crick of DNA fame, any theory that can account for all the facts is wrong because some of the facts are always wrong. You can never trust the observations 100%. And so even the question is, what is, if we're looking for scientific truth, what is the nature of it? And I love this statement of John Wheeler, who said that every law of physics pushed to the extreme will be found to be statistical and approximate, not mathematically perfect and precise. I love it because in some sense it means that these scientific theories can survive because they're approximate in some deep sense. There's always room for improvement. Just want to finish this little episode with one of my favorite anecdotes. Some of you might have relived that, but it was an episode that actually happened in England some time ago when somebody was making an omelet and found to her surprise that not only the first, the second, but all six eggs had double yolks. So when this happened, it turns out that the chance of an egg to have two yolks is 1 in 1,000. So this event was 1 in 10 to the 18. And then it was covered in serious newspapers, and there was a whole discussion. I love to say it was the chicken and egg experts that came in there, you know. how could this have happened? Where was DNA evolved? Were these eggs pre-selected that they all have the same size? Was the same chicken or something wrong with the food? And then one of the so-called experts, he was very frank, describing he was walking through the supermarket and certainly saw boxes labeled double yolk eggs. So there's always some facts that you are not aware of. I think actually, and I try to make the case in the book too, that I think why this discussion about fundamental science, the role of them is so important. I think because we are in a tremendous transition. If you look at the role of science right now, I would say it's from going from building blocks to design. So you can say, well, these are two toy cars. One is made of metal, the other is of Lego. So what's the difference between the two toys? Well, if you go back, say, a month later, the child who's given the Lego car might have made it into an airplane. So I think the fact that we now know that nature is made out of building blocks means that the unknown has increased dramatically. We're not only studying what's out there in nature, it's about what we can possibly make. Essentially, you know, we are now at the level that theoretically any material that you can think of, you can try to produce. So you can arrange materials atom by atom. In biology, you have this field of synthetic biology, of gene editing. You can basically build any organism that you want to. I think Richard Dawkins liked to say that all of us are extremely lucky because we're winners of this cosmic lottery, that our DNA has been selected to actually be produced as a living organism. But there's an infinity of other options that are not produced. In the same way, now we know the building blocks of data, of intelligence, human or artificial, and we can all start to build new ways to discovering science. So I think this old map of, you know, we discover part of nature, perhaps 5% of the universe, and the rest of that is what we don't know, I think that's incorrect, because that's only the small fraction that has been realized in this universe after 13.8 of cosmological evolution. We should think of the universe of possibilities, everything that we can possibly make. And so we have to explore this exponentially larger space. And I think we are going to do this right now. That's why, you know, I think any scientist is incredibly optimistic about where the world is going in terms of scientific discovery potential. Yet, and I think that has been my frustration, even this last year, talking about the need of basic research, I think we made very little progress in arguing. I think if Flexner would now be here, they said, well, okay, you have had 70 years to make the case. So is everybody now sold on this idea that he would have like a mixed feelings? Because I think we still have to do a lot of effort to make the point. So I think the first point is, of course, that knowledge by and of itself is incredibly valuable. Flexner himself writes, you know, great physics theory of a mathematical result is like a poem or a symphony, you know, just by itself has incredible value. That's like the first order effect. But then there are the second order effects. When we know that this generates these transformative ideas and technology. The most famous example, for instance, in my field, particle physics, is the development of the World Wide Web. When you have 10,000 particle physicists who have to work globally to produce one experiment, they have to rethink also the way they communicate. And the web was built and born out of that. You have to, as I said, to develop these tools and techniques. You're attracting the best minds. So it's remarkable we see this here too, that you know, there's just this incredible attraction of hard problems. You know, if you really have a sharp mind, you want to climb the highest mountain and the most difficult problems. And then these minds might wander around in the world. You know, we have quantum theorists that go into Wall Street and destroy the world or something. it drives innovation and startups in a very, very incredible way. But perhaps most important, I think, it's all these benefits, they're very hard to capture. Now, they cannot be captured by an individual or an institution or a company. I would say not even a region or a country. In the end, basic research is a public good. It spreads around the world. That's why I have this image of the river delta behind it. And I think actually that's why, to a large extent, it has to be publicly supported, because it, I think, is one of the few things that really is benefiting the whole world. I would say that even, you know, there has been some work of economists, etc., to quantify this, but I think more could be done. There was a report issued by the European Commission this year who argued, they calculated that 10% growth in R&D leads to 1.1 to 1.4% increase in GDP across Western nations. So that means a multiplier of 5 to 7. Now, if a politician learns that, oh, he can spend a dollar in gain 7, it's almost too good to be true. I think probably they've been fed too many stories that were too good to be true, that, you know, we are perhaps not taking that serious. But it's a remarkable number. It's a remarkable number. There are many examples you can make. MIT has calculated that it generated 30,000 companies with almost 5 million employees with annual revenues of $2 trillion. Now, there are many parents to a success, so I think if we calculate these numbers for all universities, probably it adds up to more than 100% of the economy, but no, that's clearly tremendous. And I mentioned in the book the famous grant that was given to Stanford, a National Science Foundation grant of $4.5 million to think of new ways to search the web. Famously led, the two graduate students were Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and they famously started Google with that idea. The last time I checked, it had a 712 billion market cap, so it's almost a multiplier of 200,000. And people make the case, if you have an investment that multiplies by 200,000, means that you can have 199,999 failing grants and still come out ahead. So there are tremendous upscale risk. If Flexner would he be here, these are the US numbers, but I think they're very similar across, I'm sure Canada is similar. You see that on the one hand, after World War II, there was this tremendous uptick, a strong belief across the world that basic research is important. Lots of science foundations, research grants, organizations were created. That whole line kind of peaks around 1963, 64, where in the US it was 2.1% of GDP, very similar numbers across the world. And then it starts this slow and steady decline. In relative, so as a share of GDP, of course, in absolute numbers, research money has been increasing because the economy has been growing. But in some sense, our research efforts have not kept pace with the growth of the economy. This is, by the way, also true even in the life sciences. These are the numbers for the Institute of Health in the US. Even there, in real dollars, it has been going down apart from the stimulus in 2008. And if you look what makes up the share of R&D expenditure, you also see that now business has been smaller and smaller fraction. It's the typically universities, governments, philanthropy that has been going up. And so we're in a different world. I think, you know, it's we all think back, you know, there were these labs like Bell Laboratories in the United States that created at least 8 Nobel Prizes within the lab for the transistor, for the cosmic background radiation, for the laser, and many more if you think in terms of their alums. And so I think it's hard to see across the world where that kind of dedication to basic research is that used to be the case also in industry. I think many universities complain that the research components have been kind of put on their plate on top of all their other needs. And actually young scientists are complaining. This was a spread in Nature magazine. Can't read the small print, but under pressure, it's clear. If you look at, particularly I think in the life sciences, these days a life scientist, certainly in the US, gets their first independent grant when they're age 45. Which is quite remarkable. You know, it's suppose you are in a business where only at 45 you can have some responsibility. I think that would be is a very bad deal. So I think the opportunities haven't kept up with the growth of talent. I would say the challenges, and so we have to deal with this. And one thing I think it's part of this is that also the world has become more complicated. I like to my dystopian point of view would be, there's this funny thing that, you know, science progresses and we learn more and more about the world, but it's more complicated. It's actually very complicated to understand what's happening within your smartphone, what the latest personalized medicine is exactly doing at the molecular level. So it becomes a little bit of a black box. On the other hand, no, it becomes much more effective. So science is both far away and incredibly close. So I feel the border between science and society, ordinary life and research, is becoming this kind of fractal. Our little bits of science are everywhere around us. And so my dystopian view is that at some point we will be totally unaware of what's happening in research and we'll be totally controlled by it. So I think we have to bridge that gap. And that's very difficult in a modern world, which, you know, knowledge is fragmented. People speak about the University of Google. My famous quote is here from a very dear theoretical physicist that unfortunately passed away, Sidney Coleman, who said, the problem with the global village is all the global village idiots. And, you know, it's true. At this moment, it's very difficult to find, you know, who is validating a particular piece of scientific knowledge. And we see this. It's used against science. So the complexity is used against this. This was something that was used to criticize the healthcare system in the US. You know, if it's so complicated, it must be wrong. You know? And you just see this incredible gap between how scientists and politicians look at the world, you know, whether they read the data or read the polls, and often make this case, you know, if you think, what makes science? What's universal? In fact, we believe we understand the laws of physics at the back end of the universe. It's incredibly precise, it's rational, we are in the long-term game, and it's win-win. Any piece of scientific increase in knowledge, even if you know that something doesn't work, is a win for everyone. Politics often, it's different, it's very national, it's to be inclusive. Very difficult to make very precise statements in politics. You lose everyone. It's very emotional. It's short-term. And it's often zero-sum. Like either you be elected or your opponent. So how do we bridge that gap? And I think here I want to bring a view, and that will be the final piece I want to tell you, where Flexner is very adamant. And I'm actually totally agreeing with him. He says there's this wonderful phrase where it's a curiosity we may or may not eventuate as something useful is probably the outstanding characteristic of modern thinking. It's not new, it goes back to Galileo, Bacon, and Isaac Newton, and it must be absolutely unhampered. I think Flexner was correct to identify what is the driving force of science. I think it's our innate curiosity. And I mentioned in my essay, one of my favorite anecdotes, which about Arthur Wellesley. He was the Iron Duke. He defeated Napoleon in Waterloo, reason why we're here. He was, by the way, called the Iron Duke because as a prime minister, he was so unpopular, he had to reinforce his windows because they would try to break in. So that's why he was called the Iron Duke, not his savvy on the battlefield. And he made this wonderful phrase that in all business of war and life, it's about finding out what's at the other side of the hill. And he took this quite literally. So when he was retired, he took some friends who went to a different part of the country that none of them had visited. And the game was to find out what's on the other side of the hill. Is there a lake? Is there a forest? Is there a town? And he was apparently very good. Of course, you can check. Now, the good thing is you can, in the scientific process, we have our imagination, which is envisioning what's behind the hill, like the tunnel vision to look through the barriers. But then there's our curiosity, just kind of go and look and see whether you're right or not. So I feel this is something that we really need to emphasize because I noticed that, you know, the role of imagination and curiosity is actually, it goes much further than just basic research. As Flexner pointed out, it's an essential point of being human. And I want to illustrate this with another famous Dutch scientist, which is Van het Hof. So Jacobus van het Hof was the first Nobel laureate in chemistry. So in 1901, like to joke, the Dutch had 100% of all Nobel Prizes in chemistry at that point. There's a nice graph for you on the Nobel Prize website where they color code the fraction, and you see it's all orange in the first year, and then, you know, there's a lot of black from Germany, and then, you know, all the other colors or something, but it starts all orange. His claim to fame was that he was the first to realize that molecules were three-dimensional. So that means if your molecule and you look at its mirror image, it's not necessarily the same molecule, like a left hand and a right hand. And in fact, you know, almost all your molecules in your body have this specific chirality. They're all right-handed. He's dear to me because this was a statue of his. It's still there, next to my secondary school. So every day when I walk to school, I pass this statue, and it's also, I think, a sign of the times, you know, how, in that case, a small nation revered its scientific heroes. And as such, you know, his claim to fame was the chiral molecules, like DNA or any other molecule of life. But the point I'm telling the story is then when he actually published his theory, he was intensely criticized. This is from a review of his work by Edward Kolbe, who was the famous German chemist. Von der Hoff at that point was at the veterinary school, and so he makes this kind of joke, you know, he didn't really, his criticism was he wasn't really arguing very precisely. He mounted his flying horse and flew to the mountaintop and just declared it to be true. Literally a leap of the imagination. And Von der Hoff was incredibly upset by this criticism, so when he was finally made a professor, his inaugural lecture had the title "The Power of Imagination in Science," because he felt... So the remarkable thing, I read actually the original essay, and there's a second paragraph. And the second paragraph says, if Germany is not able to produce these visionary thinkers, we will lose the war on talent, something like this, you know? So it's actually very complimentary, but very, very, you know, he was actually praising Von der Hoff, but apparently he was so upset that he only read the first paragraph. And then, but then in his inaugural lecture, he does something very interesting. He takes a scientific approach to this question. And he looks back at that time at three centuries of scientific discovery and makes a list of the 200 most famous scientists around. So 200. And he puts them in three buckets. The first is those without imagination, so no interest in the arts, in music, and theater. The second is those with imagination, so who went to plays, who read poetry, collected paintings, made music. And the third one is the group that he calls those with perverse amount of imagination, so interest in alchemy, metaphysics, you know, all kind of crazy stuff, crackpots. And then in that list is pretty impressive. So here are some of the names: Descartes, Ampère, Leibniz, Newton, all of these really famous guys. Now, Newton was famous that he was interested in alchemy. And I actually understand this. Now, think about it. Now, this is one of the famous characterizations of Newton by the astronomer Lagrange, who said, you know, Newton must be the happiest person who has ever lived in the history of humanity, because there's only one system in the world, and he discovered it. Well, first of all, we know there are many systems, you can go on, but Anisels was a very grumpy person, so I love that. But I imagine, you know, if you were discovering fundamental laws of nature, why not the laws of chemistry or the laws of nuclear physics, what actually turning lead into gold is? You know, a few years ago, they used a large particle accelerator to actually produce gold in this way. It's a very expensive way to make gold, but it can be done out of lead. And why not discovering the theory behind theology or history? So we overachieve. So I think it's a wonderful example where certainly Newton was aware how much he didn't know. Or that actually is allowed to understand. In some sense, he discovered the notion of a law of nature. And so why aren't there law of natures in nuclear physics? So for there are. It was too early. So this kind of idea of overreaching and importance of imagination, I think, is absolutely crucial. One of my favorite anecdotes, and most of you must know them, of Einstein, is when as a young boy he was giving this magnet, actually a compass, and was amazed how the needle was always pointing north, as many children would. And then he describes that he walked through the room with the compass and was still pointing north. He said, wait a moment, there must be something that's steering the needle. Which we would say, well, he discovered the magnetic field. Which is like the perfect anecdote, because all of his work is about fields, you know, gravitational field, everything. There's something in empty space or in space that is driving things. And this was as a five-year-old. And he has this wonderful quote that, you know, imagination is more important than knowledge, because it's the imagination that encompasses everything that we're going to understand and haven't understood yet. So one thing I noticed talking about the role of basic research, that many people say, well, it's very important, it's important for economy, it's important for our innovation, but I also noticed it's important for other things, you know, whether you're in education or you're in the arts or perhaps in politics. The innate characteristics of science are important there too. I haven't found the original citation, but apparently there was a creativity test developed for NASA engineers, which very strict. Only 2% of people passed the test, and somebody had done the brilliant idea to give the test to five-year-olds, and apparently 98% passed. Now, I don't know about you, I don't want to be on a spaceship designed by five-year-olds, but there is something that, you know, a five-year-old thinks outside the box very easily. It's very difficult to keep them inside the box. So it's true that, you know, when we face with reality and we learn our fields, we have to be constrained in our imagination, but, you know, we shouldn't switch it off. And I think here is where the conflict between Einstein and Flexner came. And I think that became very much into play, by the way, last year with the current events in the United States. In fact, we had a group of young scholars and scientists at the Institute who felt what's happening in the world, they wanted to go back, and they actually read a lot of the correspondence between these giants. And it turned, the Flexner had ultimately completely different point of view on the role of science than Einstein had. When Einstein was on the boat from Antwerp to New York, Flexner writes a cable, says, Professor Einstein, make no political statements. Keep a low profile. When he finally arrives, he gets invited to the White House. Flexner intercepts the invitation, writes back to President Roosevelt, you understand, Albert Einstein is a very important scientist. He has much better things to talk to than actually go to social events. And Einstein kind of explodes. In his own words, he said, you know, the world decided to interact with me, so I interact with the world. And I think these two attitudes, well, certainly in times of distress, whether we should kind of go underground, so to say, or retract in our bubble, or we should kind of fight back, that was the struggle between the two. And you know, one thing I find lovely about Einstein, I've used some of his quotes, you know, he worked very hard on these quotes. You know, apparently he was shaving them, and when he finally had a good quote, his secretary typed it out, they cut it out, and they put it in a little wooden box. So I would like to say, no, this was 50 years before the invention of Twitter, but in some sense he was already tweeting, you know. There's a lot of power in words, and his view on the world was incredibly influential. And I think that this kind of magical feeling, I think that, you know, here Perimeter's in such a successful way highlighting, I think, you know, the this wonder of the world, I think we should share too. It's not only our technology, it's our ignorance, our sense of wonder, the deep facts of the world that actually we can share. And it's much easier to share than perhaps the technological and the technical details. And I want to finish by one final anecdote, and that's something about my own experience with public engagement. So I was once asked on I developed a website in the Netherlands for experiments that children can do at home without any equipment. And in fact, it was my first year students who mostly developed this. And it's quite successful, you know, we have a few thousand kids go to the website each day. And so they asked me, can you demonstrate one thing? So I demonstrate, okay, you can do this at home. You fill a balloon with water. And then for drama, you hold the balloon above somebody's head, you take a lighter and try to burn a hole in the balloon. Oh, you could add a little drum ruffles to excitement. And of course, nothing happens. You won't be able to burn a hole in the balloon. And I did it, and I think I'll explain why. So it's, you know, it's very difficult to heat water. If you have an empty kettle on the stove, you can burn your hand very soon, but if it's filled with water, it'll take a long time. So I explained, oh, that's why if you live close to the sea, you have a moderate climate, there are many ways you can tie this on. So I felt very good of myself. I could explain some elementary physics to a large audience. And then the next morning, I get an email from a very famous Dutch physicist. He says, Robert, I saw you on television, I love the experiment, but you do understand that your explanation was totally wrong. And you know, that's the sinking feeling. I think anybody who does any outreach is thinking, you know, if you make a mistake, it makes it worse. So you know, you better not say anything or you just stick to your calculation. So, so what did I do wrong? He said, you didn't show the experiment to explain about the properties of thermodynamics or specific heat. You explained the you did the experiment because you know there is a law of nature that's preventing you from burning the hole. It always works because you can trust science. And that's what you should have said. And I think he was right. So I think I made a mistake, which a mistake I think we often make, is that we focus on the small part. It's very exciting. It's wonderful, and you know, that's what you sign. But there is a bigger picture that we can share. And that's that, you know, there is something, you know, in science that everybody can experience. There's a wonderful phrase that was coined by John Wheeler, was very good with words. They describe physics as magic without magic. Oh, and that's wonderful. It looks like magic, but it's actually a law of nature doing it. It's not a stage trick. So I think that's incredibly important. So I want to finish, you know, with I've got one very good question, and I want to ask that question to you, and you should think about it yourself. Now, if you could wave a magic wand, and there was one thing of science that everybody in the world would understand, what would you pick? So I pick your favorite, but my answer was the scientific method, which is a little bit of a clever answer, you know, because it encompasses all of the other scientific facts. But now the scientific process of having an observation, doing experiments, building a theory, going back, seeing that the approximations of the truth is an iterative process, that you have to be aware of your knowns and unknowns. You have to be open for new phenomena. I think actually, if in some sense are able to share these qualities of science, which I would say is the heart of science, the heart of basic science, I think we'll be in a better place. Thank you very much.
Let me start with one. You mentioned the fact that the percentage investment in research relative to GDP has sort of stopped growing. What do you think the factors that explain that are?
Well, I think there was certainly, I think there was a great sense of urgency in the 1950s, 60s. I think the Cold War played an important role. I think it perhaps in some sense was the success of science too. I think, you know, in some sense, the economy started growing very, very rapidly. So these numbers are as a percentage of GDP. You know, but to be completely honest, I don't understand it. Because I think if all the numbers show that this really pays off with an incredible multiplier. So, you know, I think it's what you have seen is that and this is something that's a much bigger discussion. What happened is that, you know, science, when it started growing, it created this whole kind of infrastructure. Well, universities, granting institutions, granting schemes. And one thing I've been observing, and I think there's something that many of us share, is that not only the percentage of our economy that we spend in R&D has been typically declining, although some countries have boosted it, you know. I know in Europe, like Germany has been a good example. There's countries like Korea who really boosted them terrifically. But on top of it, I think the whole system has become much more rigid. So one part I didn't mention here, but it's in that big piece in Nature, there's a wonderful quote by Bruce Alberts, who former president of the U.S. National Academy of Science, where he says, we have to think of ways to stimulate original thinking. So there's a lot of more of the same. So there is a certain risk averseness that's creeping into the scientific world in general. And you see this, I think. You know, you see that many granting institutions across the world want to see immediate returns. You have to indicate what the effect of your work is in 5 years and 10 years. So apart from just the amount of money, I think it's also shifting to kind of a comfortable middle region. And I think the long tails were, in some sense, the more high risk but very effective, in the end, transformative ideas come. That these tails have been kind of narrowed and are shifting. And I think it's institutions like Perimeter who are kind of uniquely poised and posed in that tail. But I think that's clearly something that's happening. I also feel that there are lots of other areas which are competing for interest and for money. And as a scientific community, we see that most governments, it's like whether it's security or it's healthcare or other education, they're very important and very valuable goals to invest. I think we're failing to make the point that actually in research investment is actually also attacking these issues. So you not only want to, of course, clearly you want to have a safe and secure country, but you want to do it in a clever way. You want to spend money in healthcare, but you want to do it in a clever way. And so it's very hard to imagine modern healthcare without the whole revolution in molecular life sciences have happened. And so in some sense, I think basic science has become kind of disconnected of these areas. And they have been, I think, so in some sense, it's being pushed out by others, perhaps. Yeah.
Have you given much thought to what the education system in different countries should be doing to foster the types of ideas you've suggested?
Well, one thing I would argue that what's happening in technology, I haven't touched everything that's happening in the artificial intelligence or whatever. I mean, clearly machines are taking over more of what we do. And I would argue that something which is the essential human aspect of being curious, of able to think outside the box, we are, in some sense, the human mind is able to learn a certain skill, but then go to the next level, which is very difficult for computers to do. A computer can learn how to play Go. They won't think, well, let's play tennis instead, something that. So I think these skills are incredibly important. And I think they're not, to put it mildly, they're not overemphasized in schools, I would say across the world. I think honestly, if you ask people here, give me the names of 10 or five great innovators in education, say of the last decade or two, at the same level of people who innovated technology or innovated science, we have difficulty coming up with the names. And perhaps some people may call Khan Academy or something. So it's an online, very little thinking goes to it. And in fact, I would argue that the educational systems are the most conservative around. And we haven't seen much. And it's remarkable if you see what drove the scientific revolution in, say, the early 20th century. In many countries, actually, was innovations in high school systems that somehow was able to attract completely different talent pools. So I think we were in desperate need for that. And so I think, I feel that, as scientists, we definitely have to make the case for science. But I would say some of the values of science are equally important. The kind of the research attitude, the explorative, experimental attitude that comes to being a scientist is incredibly important in every walk of life. So, I feel there's a great need to make that case. And you could argue perhaps that, again, if you have an inward look of science, we don't care. We only worry whether our students have the skills in math and physics that we need. I think there's a bigger picture here to address.
Okay, so we now have two mics. So if you put your hand up, we'll get a mic to you. This one over here.
How do you deal with the trade-off between moving scientific knowledge out of labs or academe into either the public sphere or locked in some commercial enterprise? mean, there's a kind of a, there are various institutes and places where they go out of their way to make their things totally publicly available and shareable. How do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very difficult question. I immediately have to say I'm not an expert in thinking about, you know, science and innovation systems. But I think one thing we do observe, that if you look at the successful modes, is often where there are, you know, it's really about partnerships. It's, you know, thinking non-linearly. So I think kind of, I've seen some terrific examples of kind of open innovation systems where, you know, you have lab spaces that are shared both with companies, smaller companies, universities. I think collaboration is essential. So I think one thing which you see is a major trend in science. And you can just see the average size of a collaboration writing a paper. You know, it's an exponentially growing. You know, not only in particle physics where we write papers with 3,000 authors or something, but, you know, in many, many fields. So I personally feel that we are going in a next stage where, in some sense, it's more about building ecosystems and having an open attitude, which in the end I think will pay off. And I, you know, there are many examples. I think, I mean, the successful ecosystems in the world have that characteristic. So I think probably what worked in the 1950s, where you had Bell Lab, which was like one little bubble in which it could happen, that's probably very difficult to replicate. I think now we have much more a system where there's many, many connections. And I personally, for instance, I've seen this very close up in the Netherlands, which actually is one of the leading nations in terms of doing private-public partnerships, that actually could be very effective. So I think we have to think about new kind of forms of life, so to say, in the whole system. And I think that's where creativity actually will pay off. Yes.
Hi. I would like to ask you about the case you made about graduate students and scientists that have tougher times nowadays. And what is, like, in your opinion, the duty of grad students and scientists in order to, like, propagate this usefulness of uselessness? Mm.
That's a terrific point. So one thing I think is really is an enormous change, I would say, with now, with, say, 50 years ago. I think traditionally how it was seen in science is that, you know, you go through various stages of life. You know, you're a graduate student and a postdoc and then faculty, and at some point you get a senior position, and then at that point you start to worry about the rest of the world. You know, you might do policy advice or you might write a book. One thing I noticed is that, you know, these days younger generation of scientists are very eager to be part of that conversation. One thing which is very successful, so I worked with this group of National Academies of Sciences, and one of the most successful product we developed were a thing we call Young Academies, which is, I mean, young, quote unquote, so from mid-30s to mid-40s, but scientists who are still at a, you know, crucial period of their career, being engaged with outreach, being engaged with policy advice. In fact, you know, I noticed that government agencies would love to talk to these younger scientists because they are actually going to live the life that you're designing. You know, and what I find very nice to see, I think that the modern role of a scientist is much more like a multitasker. Not for everyone. But I see many very talented young scientists who are terrific in their research, but also love to do some outreach collectively sometimes. Individually, think about. So one thing we did with the Academy is that whenever we had a report or something, we made sure that some of these young members are part of the study. And I think this is really a change. So you see the voice, I would say, of younger scientists is much more heard. And what I noticed in terms of reception, whether it's government or intergovernmental organizations, they're very, very interested to hear the voice of the younger generation. I think, you know, actually, I think in some sense it's... and I love that, because now if you think of physics, the great thing is you can be a graduate student, you know, have a brilliant idea, and, you know, earn a Nobel Prize. Has been done. You know? My thesis advisor was like that. And so we are totally open to new voices, and we are very, it's a meritocracy. You know, you're as good as your ideas are. So I think it's something that I see as very positive, that more and more young scientists are playing a role. And particularly, I think what we experience with these academies, that particularly in the developing world, like for instance in Africa, these young academies got a lot of traction, because I think in some of these countries it's really important to empower the next generation. So that might be part of the solution, I think.
Is there something that could be learned from the relationship between Flexner and Einstein to help the scientists to more efficiently inform the public?
Well, as I said, you know, I find it very touching that last year we had this group of scientists and historians studying their conversation. And in some sense, you know, the fight between Einstein and Flexner was won by Einstein. And Flexner himself at some point indicated, well, I take your point of view, and then he very actively started working on this. I must give you one little bit of folklore, which was a tremendous experience for me. So I met this summer we met Dr. Joseph Schein. So he is 102. He's the oldest living Princeton University alum. He started his university studies in 1933. And he was Jewish, and he was from a public school. He was very much the odd man out. And he became a friend. Abraham Flexner became his friend. And he has one anecdote that he wanted to... Princeton just started religious Jewish services on Friday. And this Dr. Joseph Schein went to Flexner and asked him, do you know a speaker who could attract a crowd? And Flexner knew the person, so together they went to Einstein. So he observed them. So I was, that's wonderful, you know. I was arguing what was the relationship between the two. Well, how can you need an 18-year-old student that lives to 102, and actually it does, you know. So we have this live witness, and he's exactly pointing out his thing. He said, Flexner, you know, he moved in the highest circles. He was a member of all the clubs in Europe, in the U.S., and he had kept a very low profile. He was very effective, but he was an insider. And Einstein was the ultimate outsider. And so that clash, we described many anecdotes of this. And I think, you know, in the end, I would say that, you know, it's the outsider's view of that prevailed. And I think Einstein had the right phrase. You know, if you as scientists, you can say, well, leave me alone, but the world won't leave you alone. He of course, experienced this very... So I think in some sense that... I saw this for the current group of scholars. It was very instructive for them to see this discussion, because I think whenever something happens, and we had this very much with the current administration in the United States, that, you know, scientists, young scientists, say, what should we do? We want to do something. So how should we... And I think this kind of idea that, you know, in the end, not all of us, but some of us want to be proactive and take a stance and do something. I think that's I think what I learned from that discussion. And, you know, it's very hard to find a mistake in Einstein's thinking. So I think he was right here too. Yes.
I want to follow up with another thought from Einstein, because many of the things you said are kind of hard to disagree with.
Yes.
But when you talk to politicians, many of them would disagree. One of the things that Einstein said about that is you cannot just disentangle the advancement of science from other aspects of politics. He himself mentioned he was a pacifist.
Yes.
He also was a socialist.
Yes.
In fact, he mentioned once that a capitalist society would cripple individuals and lead to the erosion of human creativity, which is one of the things you're advancing. Shouldn't we as scientists speak out more explicitly, like Einstein did, not just say, oh, we want more science, but point to, like he called it, the real source of evil in this world?
Well, I think, you know, the question to which extent you are, you know, engaged with the world in a larger sense, I think it's a personal choice. It's a personal choice, and I think you're right to point out, I mean, that's also a mistake sometimes scientists make, is that you think, well, you know, we... Our aim is to search the truth. So, you know, when we communicate to politicians, they, you know, give them instructions, so to say. Well, clearly, you know, life as a politician is very different because you, science is only one part of the equation. You know, you might have your beliefs, you might have reality, political reality. You might want to win an election, or you were elected on a certain platform. So science is only part of that story. So I think one thing, again, I'm not making any statements about what the right way is to engage with life in general. I have very little to say. But I think, you know, there's always this struggle with science. And on the one hand, certainly if you're an active researcher, it's your love, it's your life. You can't take anything kind of more serious. But on the other hand, you have to be aware that on the greater scheme of things, it's only one ingredient into a larger puzzle. I think our aim is to give it the rightful place, and which is, you know, we shouldn't oversell, but also not undersell. And I think that's in some sense a struggle, I think. And then that's something that, you know, you have to continuously update that. And I think, you know, one thing we also have to do, and I noticed with whether it's making the case for science or just educating the people, it's a continuous effort. And I think that's something that, you know, to kind of, and it is my own feeling that, you know, there is also perhaps a tendency to kind of underestimate the you know, receptiveness of the message of science in the public at large, but also in politicians. So I think, you know, that would be a great risk if we kind of underplay our cards.
This is somewhat along the same line. You mentioned the scientific method, which basically has been accepted internationally by all
Yes.
countries, all scientists, and so on. Even at the height of the Cold War, there was open communication across the
Yes.
the boundaries.
Yes.
Do you think that scientists have something to teach governments, the world, as to how to interact through this type of approach to the way they work for others?
Well, I think you make a very good point that indeed, during the most intense periods, there always was communication between scientists, you know, whether it's between the Soviet Union and the US. I think that actually there still is. There still is a very high level. And in fact, you know, even in the most, I know the United States and Iran have been collaborating scientifically. There have been efforts to try to collaborate with North Korea. I think, you know, there's something that science can play a certain role. I would say, you know, as you say, let's agree on certain facts of reality that are underpinning these conversations. And in fact, reality that, you know, is very real. If you want to know how a certain nuclear arm works or doesn't work, or how it can be detected or not detected. So I think there is, I think that's underplayed, this idea that science has, and in fact, it has also been very influential in bringing nations together. I know after World War I, many scientists brought, you know, it was actually the discussions that were entertained in physics and other places that brought, you know, Germany back into the fold. I mean, my favorite example is actually CERN. You know, just after the war, all the European nations want to collaborate with the United States in the nuclear program, and the US said, no, you collaborate with yourself, you know, among yourself. I think, you know, Germany was part of that collaboration before they were part of the European Union. So, I mean, and it's remarkable. I find it still uplifting to see how in places as CERN, you know, you have literally former weapon labs from the former Soviet Union contributing technology that's actually quite relevant, whether it's, you know, or having natural resources that are relevant. So again, we shouldn't overplay it, but I think it's a very important stable element in a world that's often, you know, driven by political facts. And it's great that it's, as you say, it's a scientific method, it's the it's this kind of a tautology that, you know, facts in the end have the last word. I think that drives people to collaborate. And it's very unfortunate that this is not well considered. I think, you know, often I find a great pleasure. There's something remarkable. I think science, on the one hand, you know, it's universal and each nation deals with the same laws of physics. On the other hand, It's also enriching to see that each nation has its own scientific culture with slightly different emphasis, local strengths and weaknesses, perhaps also cultural connotation is different. I think that actually adds value to, certain countries, I think we have stereotypes. For most people, they're not aware that indeed a country like Iran has this many, many century deep love of math and physics and great tradition, and we tend to ignore this. I think, you know, there are these, sometimes the idea, you know, you have these programs where you find the genealogy of a famous person, and it turned out they have relatives all over the world, and you could almost take a genealogy of an idea or something and see how it has moved across. And I don't think we teach that enough. The fact that, you know, people think that something, you know, the computer was invented in the United States, well, you can go back all the way to Babylonian times. And so I think we should be more aware of this fact that it is something that has been bringing people and countries together for many centuries. Yeah.
I'm interested in the intersection between science and the arts.
Yes.
And I found it very interesting what you were saying about how, you know, the really brilliant scientists had these interests in, you know, alchemy and these really far out fields, and that scientists that have interest and activities in the arts and music and humanities, you know, there's a history of some really great scientists having great interest in those activities. So is it that the arts act as a synergy to their scientific research, or is it because you're involving different parts of your brain that then makes your scientific activities more productive because you're more curious and you're thinking more outside of the box? So just wondering if you have any comments on that.
Well, it's a huge theme, and it's there's a lot to be said about it. But my short answer would be that, you know, I think science and art both, you know, they have this, they're of this world, but not quite. So, you know, that it's a little bit like a parallel universe. But they have some very important things in common. And I would say, now, often we emphasize the kind of shiny outside. Now, for artists, it's, you go, the things that you see in museums, etc. And for science, it's, you know, it's the great discoveries and the prizes. I think actually the most interesting interaction is the interior, where it's much more fragile. It's, I would say, the explorative process. And I think they can learn from each other. So one thing I think the arts can learn is, I often say, get organized. So I think, you know, if you see in the early 19th century, both art and science was like a gentleman's game or something. And then, you know, science has exploded. We have labs, we have universities, we have granting agencies. It's self-governed, which is, I think, a great thing in science, that, you know, the people leading the institutions are scientists themselves. The arts are something where are much more fragile, I think much more on their own and less protected. I think, so they can learn, I think the arts can learn from science to be, you know, make the case more strongly, but I think actually from scientists we can learn from art that art plays much more emphasis on the process, so not so much on the outcomes. So if you go to an art school, you learn a lot about the ways in which you can explore your own creativity and exploration, while traditional methods of teaching, say in math, is to solve the problem set, right? And not so much about the process itself. So I think that's something where we could learn from each other. I think actually in some sense we are both in this kind of long game, allowing our society to create this kind of open space to think and explore. I think you by joining forces there, you strengthen. Now there are many initiatives, for instance, there is this whole program of primary, secondary education, where you not only emphasize the sciences and math, but you put the arts in. So I think there are many ways which you can explore. And I feel, personally, I think it's a loss that these fields were split apart. I think, again, if you go back to the more kind of romantic area of science, say, two centuries ago, then these things were very natural. I think, you know, you had great discoveries. These discoveries were publicly shared. Often there were wonderful illustrations, etc., or painters or poets were inspired by the scientific discoveries. I think we lost some of that. And if you say, well, we have to also emphasize the wonder, the imagination in science, I think arts can be a really good companion in that. Yes. And I think actually the arts could benefit by being part of this larger effort to stimulate, I would say, you know, curiosity and curiosity-driven thinking.
Thanks, Robert. Thank you.